From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Peter Stamm, author of the novels The Sweet Indifference of the World, To the Back of Beyond, All Days Are Night, 7 Years, On a Day Like This, Unformed Landscape, and Agnes, and the short story collections We're Flying and In Strange Gardens and Other Stories. His award-winning books have been translated into more than 30 languages. For Peter Stamm's entire body of work and his accomplishments in fiction, he was shortlisted for the Man Booker International Prize in 2013, and in 2014 he won the prestigious Friedrich Hölderlin Prize. He lives in Switzerland. Peter Stamm's latest book is a story collection, It's Getting Dark, published by The Other Press. When I spoke to him, he was in lockdown after contracting COVID. Luckily, he was feeling well and was at the end of his quarantine, but you'll hear us refer to that, and you may wonder what was going on. Our interview begins with me talking and asking my first question. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I wanted to talk a little bit about time and timing in a story. Now, in Marcia from Vermont, you sort of open with Peter leaving the foundation and kind of looking back at what's happened in the 2 months that he was there. But you kind of zoom in and out a little bit. Sometimes he's in New York, and then all of a sudden we're back in Vermont again. And I'm wondering how you like to structure time in a story.
I think it's basically my interest that leads me through time. So I'm not, time, there is a tendency to show time in chronologically, but that's not how we think. I think we go from one point in our lives to another point, and just by thinking about something, or so something leads to the next thought, and this thought might have happened like a long time ago. So it's a back and forth all the time. I'm constantly experimenting with it. I think it's very boring when you have kids and they tell you about a film they've seen. It's usually and then and you realize it's just the best film gets extremely boring if you just tell it chronologically.
Right.
So I try to somehow make my books more alive by moving in time as I move in space.
Yeah, and I really had the sense that you were following your character's thinking, especially when Peter gets sick in that scene in Marcia from Vermont. There's a point where Peter gets very sick, and the prose in that section is really interesting. It's sort of all over the place, and you realize you're sort of following his feverish thoughts.
Yes, and also like not just what happened a long time ago, but also what never happened.
Yes.
What's just a fantasy in his brain, and what could have happened. And so it's a whole, yeah.
Yeah, that was interesting. So you have a story called Nadigal, in which this bored, uncomfortable young man named David thinks about robbing a bank.
Mm-hmm.
And his mother gave him a squirrel mask for, I think, a party or something, and he's thinking he will wear the squirrel mask if he robs the bank. Anyway, you have this sentence, his mother would be surprised, they all would be, at what her squirrel would get up to. And it was interesting to me how that little line, they all would be, said so much about his character and about what he's looking for and how he needs to feel important in the world. You know, do you remember writing that?
Yeah, I think that's the whole point. It's not about money. I mean, it doesn't want to become rich. It's all about being somebody special, to be and to somehow know I'm so much more than what people think, and I want to show them that I'm this whatever courageous or reckless guy who will rob a bank. Or he could have probably had done something else just to show people that he's special. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And then that story made me think also about how you end your stories, and also made me think about beginnings and endings. I wondered if we could talk a little bit about beginnings and endings. First of all, I was going to ask about beginnings. How often do you stick with a story's beginning? Like, maybe you first draft, you have a certain opening. Does that tend to be the opening of the story, or do you revise it later usually?
It's fun. That's funny. The first sentence almost never change.
Yeah, interesting.
I change everything, but the first sentence is like, I've compared it to a seed, and from this seed, everything grows. So in a way, you can't change the seed. It's there, and I might change a word in the first sentence, but it's always the first sentence that stays. Sometimes it takes me a long time to find that first sentence. I've had cases where I had ideas for stories, and then it took me 10 years to find the first sentence. But once the first sentence is there, then the whole story starts to develop.
Yeah. Is it the same for novels?
Yeah.
Okay. And then for endings, what to you makes a satisfying ending?
That's hard to say. Again, it's something that just happens. I just found an ending to my new novel last week.
Oh, congratulations. That's great.
Thank you.
That's because you're isolated.
Yeah, maybe. I knew that the end was coming, that the end was near, like one of those guys with the end is near. But I didn't really know what the end would be. So suddenly I knew, and it just happened. And then it's like these things where you immediately know that's right. It's not, there was no question that could be the ending or maybe something else. It was just, I knew that that's going to be the ending.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, sometimes your endings to me seem almost more like the promise of a future than a neatly resolved event. Do you know what I mean? And I would say that story, Nadigal, is a bit like that. It's like there's this sense that we might not be included in the ending, but that we can feel comfortable that there is an ending, you know, or that there's a promise of a future. Does that?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially in that case, I think in a way that's the moment when life started for this young guy, when he decided probably not to rob the bank. We don't know. I mean, maybe he did rob the bank, but that's when everything started. So it's in a way, the story is just the beginning of what happened before the beginning.
Yeah. I liked that we don't really know if he robbed the bank. I could equally well see him in a future life looking back on this event that he didn't actually follow through on, or see him like 30 years later in jail thinking back about the mistake he made.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't decided myself whether he robbed the bank or not.
That's fun. Now, your characters almost always have jobs, and I love that. You know, a lot of stories, you never hear if the characters have a working life, which is such a huge part of most people's lives.
Of course, yeah.
And you often offer some details about these jobs. In the story Supermoon, I loved that your narrator says, "I would have a hard time explaining the nature of our work to someone on the outside." But then he goes ahead and explains it, which was funny.
That was actually a place I worked for a few years.
Oh, did you?
It was, Swiss Air Technics. And this guy existed who had a list that was his whole job. And he tried to explain it to me, but I never really got what the list was. But it was the list was very important to him.
Oh, interesting. That's funny.
He smoked like 3 packages of cigarettes every day. And that's about what he did. And his list and the cigarettes.
What did you do there?
They hired me to help them to introduce a new accounting software, but then it never took place.
Oh.
So I was there more or less. I didn't have a job. They just paid me money, and that, as I was an aspiring writer, that was perfect for me.
Yeah.
I did all kinds of things. Yeah.
Now I'm wondering if you've worked in archaeology. No. So with some of these jobs, are you doing research to figure out what has to happen, or are you making some stuff up? Because you do often give some details of the job.
Yeah, I do research. The archaeologists I visited and I talked to them, especially when you want the way they talk or what's interesting to them, then you have to talk to them. My research is usually not reading. It's usually going to places, speaking to people, and just listening to them and listening to how they talk and what they talk about.
Oh, that's great. Because so many people rely on Google, but I like that you go out into the
it's
field.
Not, yeah, you won't, that the important things are not in Google. The important things are actually in real life. And when you, like small things, and suddenly he starts talking about this skeleton they found, and that's not on Google because it's not that important. But to him, it was very important.
Yeah. Now, how much detail do you feel like you should include in describing jobs? And then do you ever sort of decide, oh, I've put too much in, it's getting boring or it's detracting from the story?
Actually, I just did that. I just took some out in my new novel. I did some research about something. It's about filmmakers. And then the filmmakers started explaining me how it actually works. And then it got so complicated that I said, no, I've just skipped that because it's not a nonfiction book about filmmaking. So I'm just do it very, just in some places, maybe three or four times in the whole book. So you can feel the feel of filmmaking, but I don't want it to be all in this speak that they have.
Mm-hmm. So your story, you have a story called Sabrina 2019, which concerns a woman who's asked to model for a sculptor. And I really found this such an interesting story. So first of all, was that 3D printing that he was using to make the sculpture?
Yeah.
So you can do that to people?
Yeah, actually, it's a friend of a friend who is the artist who showed us his exhibition, and that's when I had the idea to write the story. And it's like scanning. You scan the body, and then it's printed in 3D, and then it's they make a cast, and then it's how do you call it?
Mold,
yeah,
and then
in a foundry, molded. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. So this sculpture is, I think, aluminum and slightly larger than the real Sabrina. Mm. And she just has such a sort of interesting relationship to the sculpture and needing to kind of see it a lot and then eventually sort of personalizing it and feeling like she has a relationship with it. Needing to be around it to just kind of process how she feels about this being created. I really related to her. I feel like it would be strange, you know. I mean, if somebody does a sculpture that's a little bit, you know, interpretive, that would be one thing. But to see yourself from an actual, you know, 3D printer is something else.
Mm.
But my question is actually about something at the end of that story. At the end of that story, you shift the narrative point of view from Sabrina, the person, to Sabrina, the sculpture, sort of. And I read that paragraph over and over, trying to find the moment where that transition occurs. And I think I finally found it, but I loved that it was hard to pin down. I felt like Sabrina, the girl, was still our narrator, and she was imagining the sculpture becoming our narrator or having that sort of like animation. It was just very interesting. And I liked that it was so subtle, I couldn't find it. Can you talk about writing that?
Well, to me, it's as if she becomes the sculpture.
Okay.
So there was even a first version where the sculpture leaves the house.
Wow.
And drives back on the train, and then she's described, and then you realize it's because she still has the piercing. So you realize it's not Sabrina, it's the sculpture that is now. But that was too much a ghost story then. So I changed that.
Yeah.
That was one of the
Oh, I was going to say, you don't go quite to ghost story. I've noticed that.
No. That was one of the few cases where I had two endings, two different endings that were possible. But then, so I had to decide. And I thought it was nicer to somehow keep it again open, whether it's actually a ghost story or just some imagined thing.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I think it's time there. I mean, it's time speeding up. I mean, when she's together with this man, spending the evening at his house, and then you feel that the time is speeding up because weather is changing and the light is changing. So it's this change of speed of time that somehow is the moment when, because for a sculpture, time must feel quite different because they're always the same, and for them a year is much shorter than for us, I guess.
Yeah. I feel like similar to David, who does or does not rob the bank, Sabrina is looking for something that she can't quite put her finger on. She's looking to be important in some way. And so I like that she kind of almost becomes the sculpture. And I also like that it's always subtle. Whatever you do, it's always pretty subtle, which is nice.
Try to.
Yeah.
Try to, yeah.
It offers the reader that position of making some choices, which is more interesting than just being told everything all the time.
Yeah, and I think people shouldn't concentrate on the ghost part. I mean, it's not about ghosts. It's even if it is a ghost, it's about, as you said, it's about wanting to be somebody important, wanting to asking herself who she is and things like that, relationships between people. So even if I use the means of a ghost story, it's still not about the ghost.
Right. It's just, and it's funny because Sabrina sort of finally begins to relax and feel more comfortable once she meets Robert, I think, is the man who bought the sculpture. And he's not terribly, I won't say they're not happy people, but they're not conventionally happy people. And so once they start talking to each other, it almost feels like she can relax into whatever's going to be. Was that purposeful or was that something?
Yeah, he has his own problems. That's
exactly.
For sure. I mean,
Yeah. Mm. And it was almost like she meets somebody who's not perfect or trying to be perfect. And she's, I don't know, maybe I'm reading a lot into it. Now, I used the word ghost in a question about another story, which is Supermoon. I wondered what the impetus was. What was your initiating spark to write Supermoon other than having worked there? It was so interesting to me. He seemed like he was literally experiencing that sense of becoming obsolete as he leaves his job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sense of feeling like I don't exist if I'm not here working. It felt like he stopped existing. And that was sort of ghost-like too.
I've seen that many times. I mean, when I worked in offices, that people, I mean, it's their last day on the job, and then they say, "Well, I'll come back and we'll meet again," and they never come back. You never meet them again, and you know they disappear, even though you liked them and you knew them for years. But going into retirement is usually disappearing. But I think the main thing was I wanted somebody to disappear in a story. I think it wasn't. The story in the first place was actually this how can I make a character disappear in a story?
Yeah.
And then I found the character to.
Okay.
To do that. So very often when I start a story, it's more about the form or thing I want to do in a story. And then I find, I look for something to happen to do what I want to do.
Yeah. So you have the idea and then you sort of put it on the palette with more specifics.
Yeah. Yeah. Also the bank robbery, that was that moment that interested me. The one moment where you're standing in front of the bank and has two, it's like the two roads that I watch. I mean, you know, you can go left or you can go right. And that was only that moment that interested me.
I loved the metaphor that you used where he felt like he was at the top of the swing arc. You know, and about to be brought back down by gravity, but there he was hovering up there as he made that choice. That was great.
Even though at that point, he doesn't really have a choice. If you're on a swing,
that's
you don't
true.
Have the choice to fly away.
That's true.
Have to go back down.
You have to go back down. Can you talk a little bit about how you go about developing your characters and finding your characters? Is that all very organic for you, or is there anything that you do that helps you figure out who they are?
I never develop anything. I just write. I know there is this American way of writing that you have to know the whole biography of your character, and I don't.
Yeah,
I don't.
Some people don't.
Yeah, I just start writing and I somehow, whatever I know about a character, I learn during the writing. So if I'm at a certain point and I ask myself, does she or he have brothers or sisters, then that's a decision I make at that moment where I need it. And I mean, I would say for most of my characters, I don't know what color of hair they have, what color, how they are dressed. And I mean, there are so many things I don't know about my characters, but I have a pretty good feeling for them. I think I would recognize them in the street. But if you would ask me, is she blonde or brown-haired, I couldn't tell you.
And you don't ever start with somebody. Well, you did. You started with that gentleman who had the list at work. Do you often start with a person in mind that you want to create a character that maybe resembles this?
Not really, no.
No.
No, that's quite seldom, no. Even the man I described in Supermoon is not the guy that worked with me. He's probably, there was another guy that's probably closer to him.
Okay.
So this heavily smoking guy was completely different from the point of view of this character.
All right, great. So, Peter, I always like to ask people what they've been reading lately that they might recommend. Do you have any books that you would recommend in isolation?
I have just next to my place here, I have Pessoa that I wanted to read for many years now.
Uh-huh.
And I might finally read it. I read a Spanish author, Javier Cercas. It's called The Soldier of Salamis, the book.
It's called what?
What else have I read? The Soldier of Salamis.
Oh, okay.
That's just, what else have I read? I've looked at lots of documentary movies because I'm writing about this filmmakers who do documentary movies. What else have I read? This summer I've read some Japanese authors, but I never remember their names.
Okay.
Sorry. One was called Snowland, I think.
Okay.
Very beautiful book, but it's not here anymore. No.
That's fine. That's great. We've got two, possibly three titles. That's great. So what can you tell us any more about your filmmaking book?
Yeah, it's funny. Some young filmmakers asked me whether they could make a film about me writing my next novel. And then I said, okay, and I thought about it, and then I decided to write a novel about two filmmakers who make a movie about, or a documentary about a guy writing a novel.
Oh,
so now it's, again, it's quite a complicated structure. But I tell the story from the point of view of the filmmakers, not from my point of view.
Right.
And then it's all about writing and filmmaking, and I decided in the middle of the book, I decided that the author is going to die. So just to make it more hard for all of us. So in my book, the author is dying in the middle.
Have they finished the documentary yet?
No, but no. I finished the book. We'll do some filming Thursday and Friday.
Oh, okay. And are they coming up to see you in your isolation, or how is that going to work?
No, actually, I'll be out of isolation on Monday, Wednesday.
Oh, okay.
And then we go to my village where part of the book is taking place. It's the village where I come from. So we do the filming there.
Oh.
And they did some filming in Paris.
Oh, okay.
Where I was this summer.
So you say the book is finished and you just found your ending last week. Are you going to have a revision period, or do you revise
as
you go?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's not finished as a book, but it's finished. Let's say that I've written the story from beginning to end.
Yeah.
But now I work at least another half year on just, yeah.
And how long did it take you to write that first draft?
Good question. Not so long, maybe 3/4 of a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's quite
fast. It was went very well.
Good.
It was really fun. This time it was really fun to write. It's going to be a funny book also.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. This is my last question. I always like to finish up by asking some advice. And in your case, I wanted to ask you, so you have a quote on the back of the book by Tim Parks. He says, Peter Stamm is an extraordinary author who can make the ordinary absolutely electrifying, hard to recommend too highly. So I agree. And I wanted to know what advice you might have for bringing an ordinary character sort of most fully to life.
Mm. I think it's all about being the person while you write
about
the book. I mean, being that person and really... I mean, you have to like that person. If you don't like him or her, then it's no use. I mean, it's not about, you shouldn't watch people from the outside and just, or make fun of them or whatever, or be say distant from the characters. And then it's all about, it's like probably like acting. I mean, I'm a very bad actor. I only tried it two or three times and that was really awful. but when I write, it's almost like acting because I have to become that person and think as that person and feel as that person. And then just let the text, let me be led by what that person would do or think or feel or whatever.
Now, you said you always like your characters. Do you always think they're likable people generally?
That's not the point when I'm writing, because I don't think about myself. I don't ask myself whether I'm likable or not. I'm just myself, so I have no choice. And when I'm a character, it's not really a point whether he's likable or not.
Right. And I guess I'm also asking a little bit, do you find that in trying to like them or empathize with them, does that change what they do? Like, I guess maybe instead of are they likable, are they reliable? Does it matter? Like if you're writing an unreliable character, is it hard for you to get into that acting role and to think about expressing things the way they're expressing their feelings?
I'd say they are reliable to themselves. I mean, they might do things that they are astonished themselves that they do that or say things, but even then it's somehow they are reliable because they are astonished themselves. So they have to be credible, but how do you do credible? That's hard to explain.
No, I guess I'm just wondering, you know, if you ever come up against, okay, like this is what this person's going to do now. And I don't know. For me, when I'm writing, sometimes I am averse to controversy, averse to conflict. And that makes it hard for me to write scenes of controversy and conflict. So I really have to work at that sometimes. Or just don't.
I think in my case, I think probably my characters would just evade conflict. And then that's how they would do it in the book.
Oh, okay. That's similar. That's interesting.
Yeah. And then you would have to deal with that. I mean, you have to deal with not having the conflict, and then probably something would happen below the surface, or I don't know, the other person would ask, why do you ever talk to me?
Right.
About?
Yes.
And then, yeah. I mean, that's what happens in Agnes, I think. Agnes is asking the guy, why don't you react?
Right.
And he's just distracting himself.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Okay. All right. Wonderful. I want to mention again, the name of the book is It's Getting Dark, stories by my guest, Peter Stamm, published by The Other Press. Peter, thank you again for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
I always enjoy it.
Yeah, it's fun.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Swiss author Peter Stamm about his new story collection, It's Getting Dark, published by The Other Press. Peter's website is in German, and it is peterstamm.ch. If you don't speak German, you can learn more by visiting his publisher's website, otherpress.com. You can also hear an earlier conversation that I had with Peter by searching for it on writethebook.podbean.com. My prompt for the week comes from my guest, Peter Stamm. Go to a cemetery and see what the stones tell you about the people who are buried there. You will learn things from the stones themselves, but also from their names and dates, from details occasionally listed on the stones, from any flowers left at the gravesides. You'll be surprised by how much you might learn about those who went before us, and you can use them to inspire you in your work. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And if you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.